This is an interview with Dr. George Stevenson, conducted by Reginald Carter on Saturday, April 2nd, 2005. Okay. George, what I like to do at the beginning of the interview is just get some biographical information. So could you kind of tell me where you were born, what state, something about your background?
Sure. Reg, I was born in a college town, DePaul University, which is in Indiana, in January 14th, 1935. Okay. Lived in Indiana during World War II, grade school. My father was the chief chemist for a big canning company during World War II called Stokely Van Camp, which made a lot of the C rations for both the United States troops as well as C rations for the Russian troops, French troops. So these little cans actually, he remembers the a French officer from the French Free Army, not the Vichy Army, was over here from like 41 through 45, and they wanted to make sure that horse meat was in the sea ration cans. And so there's trains with horses came from Kansas City, Kansas, to Indianapolis, Indiana, the stockyards. Anyway, Dad was the head of that program. Mom went to, was an orphan, and was in the an orphan home in Indianapolis when Dad met her in high school. But Mrs. Eli Lilly was a philanthropist, and she gave Mom and her brother, who was also in this orphanage, scholarships. John went to Butler University in Indianapolis. Mom went was given a scholarship by Mrs. Eli Lilly to the John Heron Art Institute. So that carried me through until I would guess 1946, and at which time we moved from, we actually lived about a few miles from the Indianapolis 500 race. I could hear the cars, and way back in those, Maury Rose was the chief driver at the time. And we moved from Speedway, Indianapolis, to Rochester, New York. I had started Cub Scouts in Indiana. When we moved to Rochester, New York, I went to high school at Brighton High School in Rochester, New York, and liked. I think I had about the largest paper route in Rochester at the time. So we sold calendars during the Christmas time, made some extra money, raised tropical fish, and sold them as sort of a young entrepreneur, 13 or 14 years old. Went through Cub Scouts and became an Eagle Scout at Tay House in Rochester, New York. And then a special program allowed me to sort of get a scholarship to college. And I went from Brighton High School and graduated early, and I went to Oberlin College, which is in Oberlin, Ohio. Mm-hmm. 4 years at Oberlin College, and was very much interested in biology, zoology, comparative anatomy, and was accepted at Case Western Reserve Medical School, which at that time was just Western Reserve Medical School. Graduated from Oberlin College in 1956. I went to Western Reserve and graduated in 1960. I had an unbelievable experience in medical school, being associated with some friends of Dr. Gene Stead, who I did not know his name at that time, but Dr. Robert Ebert was head of the Department of Medicine, and I see his picture in Gene Stead's home currently. and pictures on his wall. Dr. Fred Robbins got the Nobel Prize for his work in Brunhilde type of vaccine for polio. I did some research in medical school. Western Reserve was what they called sort of a, they had a family practice orientation. They call it the Reserve Program. I think it was ahead of Duke at that time. certainly they were, everybody was looking at the Reserve Program to see how you would get early clinical training. So we actually were called into a delivery of a child our first month in medical school. By virtue of that, when we were seniors in medical school, we followed the this child through 4 years, so the child was 4 years old when we graduated. We were the family doctor, so actually we just bought a stethoscope, a white coat at the bookstore, and so we were sort of quote doctors the first year, although we knew we really weren't, but it was a neat program. Certainly the humanist type of instinct that was instilled in the, most of the students, or all the students, did not have SNAP exams. We had three or four committee exams during each year. Well, lots of time to prepare for these arduous exams, but there was no, it seemed to decrease the stress of 4 years of medical school. So they also had a program where we would go into research, and I did research in the neuroscience field, and actually published while I was in medical school works in the Journal of Physiologists, also the Journal of American Journal of Physiology, and the Neurophysiology journals, which basically allowed me to learn about the nervous system, which I followed fully. Actually, between my third and fourth year at Reserve, Western Reserve, I got sort of a summer fellowship down at the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York City, and met a friend of Gene Stead. Again, I didn't know Gene Stead's name, but there was a Dr. H. Houston Merritt, M-E-R-R-I-T-T, who Gene Stead knew when he was at Boston City as a neurologist, a professor there. Dr. Houston Merritt moved from Boston to become the chairman of the Department of Neurology at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York City. I was a third year student and had the privilege of presenting his case report to Dr. Merritt. Dr. Merritt signed a one of his books he had just published, and last evening Gene said he'd really like to see that book and that signature. And I will show him that book when we come back next November. Upon graduation from medical school, they gave me the presidency of the Honor Medical Society, so I was president of the Alpha Omega Alpha Society in medical school. As a junior, they choose three students in the junior year, and then they help with the faculty advisor. It was Dr. Oscar Ratnoff, who was a Gene Stead would know, hematologist, and internationally known. He was our advisor, and then we chose other students in the class for our senior year. After the senior year was 1960, I took my internship at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in New York City. Spent my free time with the family, our two children, and would go to the American Museum of Natural History, where I saw the my first diorama of a huge mammal, which I had never seen before, and which I didn't see for several years, but it was an elk. And of course now we live in Wyoming and Montana, so they go through our front yards. The other time I spent secretly going up to the Neurologic Institute and then going up to the library and reading about neuroscience, neurosurgery, neurology during my internship. After the internship, I was applied to the Department of Neurology with Dr. Denny Brown in Boston, and also looked at the program of Dr. Ray Adams, the head of neurology at Mass General. And then by a fluke, I got a letter from the University of California at the other end of the nation, and then he gave me 2 weeks if I could accept the post as a first-year resident in neurosurgery. That would have been July 1st, 1961. I sort of liked technical things and liked the manipulation skill that was involved in treating the nervous system. So I took the job in San Francisco, and I had a week to get from New York City to San Francisco. Started neurosurgical residency July 1st, 1961. Finished the residency, and then during that residency I had the incredible experience of dealing with a neuro-ophthalmologist, Dr. William Hoyt, H-O-Y-T, and Hoyt and Frank Walsh from Johns Hopkins. I had written a book on neuro-ophthalmology, and I believe it's in its 19th edition now, but the first edition was published when I was a chief resident, and I got to contribute some things to that textbook. Also, we did a neurosurgical procedure that had never been done before as chief residents, where they actually allowed chief residents, myself and Dr. Ron Stoney, a very gifted vascular surgeon. He was a vascular surgery chief resident at the time, and I was chief resident, and we were allowed to do a surgery on an inoperable brain tumor, which was a chordoma immediately in front of the pons and clivus. This patient presented with inappropriate laughter, quadriparesis, then becoming almost quadriplegic. This case was published in Time magazine in the Journal of Neurosurgery, and you want to. Dr. Hoyt, this neuro-ophthalmologist friend of mine, I had written two or three articles with him on clinical cases during my residency, and these were published in various neurosurgical journals again during my residency. Having this case presented to us that this patient got progressively worse. It was like a 21-year-old boy who came to a funeral and started laughter as he was viewing the casket. This is an inappropriate laughter based on, and it had been described before, pressure on the pons, P-O-N-S, of the midbrain, and we don't know why that happens, but it's a disenfranchise of some of the emotional aspects, probably from the limbic system to long tract system, but whatever it is, that was his initial symptom. And then he progressively got weaker and weaker because this tumor, a chordoma, which is a benign tumor, was pressing on the brainstem. And then he actually came in and had a couple other procedures called a posterior fossa craniotomy, and they couldn't get around the cerebellum to get the tumor out. By that time, we had done a lot of research on cadavers, and there was a Dr. John D.C.M. Saunders, S-A-U-N-D-E-R-S, who was from South Africa, got his FRCS in London, was an anatomist, and applied for and got the job in the University of California. So he came across the pond. Became professor of anatomy at the University of California, then later became dean, later became provost and later became chancellor of the entire university, but his primary love was anatomy. He actually, with Charles O'Malley from Stanford, written several incredible books on Vesalius and Leonardo da Vinci on their early anatomical work. In his spare time, he wrote about the development of medicine in California from the Spanish times up till the 1960s. Incredible intellect. Anyway, he gave us free access to cadavers, both fresh and fixed. So we did this dissection to see how we could go through a procedure in the neck, underneath the chin, and come up and expose the base of the skull from the bottom up. So we were actually looking, made a little square window with a drill in the clivus, C-L-I-V-U-S, and when we got inside the skull, this tumor just sort of surrendered itself to suction. Tumor came out, and I think the picture of him and his son, I think that would have been 1965, and he's still living, and never recurred. And so this was discussed by me in Copenhagen at the Third International Neurosurgical Conference, in Mexico City, in Tokyo, so Dr. Stoney and I, as chief residents, and were sort of full of ourselves, if you will, getting lecture free airplane tickets. We took our wives, which was one of Gene Stead's deal, that he always took Evelyn wherever he went, and the NIH paid our way. So it was for travel awards. We had to develop some instrumentation, which were long instruments with alligator handles, so it could go from the anterior surface of the neck up to the base of the skull. And we had a lot of help. Dr. Jack Urban, or Mr. Jack Urban, came up from Burbank, California, and arranged a television set to be attached to the camera, and it was the first television in a neurosurgical operation. A few months later, Dr. William House from the House Ear Institute in LA used the same camera, and then in the that was in like 1964, November of 1964, in early 1970s, color TV came in, of course, all of them, these are all attached to a microscope, so this operation through this little window at the base of the skull had to be, it was a deep hole, we had to have long instruments, we did record it on black and white TV, no attending was in the room. I'm sure that's the only time that they would allow chief, probably in history, that chief residents performed the operation. Dr. Jack Urban, or Mr. Jack Urban, actually had a microphone from the OR up to the doctor's dressing room, so periodically we would hear from our professors, or quote, how are things going in there, George, end quote, or Dr. Wiley would talk to, who's chief of the vascular service, would talk to Dr. Ron Stoney that arranged the special retractors that would allow the a gentle retraction of the neck musculature and the esophagus and trachea away from the base of the skull. And quote, how are you doing in there, Ron Stoney, end quote. But no attending was in the room during this 11-hour operation. that was a, I went into private practice in California. The microscope was my right hand, both in soul and mind, and I did most of my operations underneath the microscope. They were just coming in at that time. Of course, now it's embellished internationally, as to you can re-implant severed fingers, ears, vascular surgery, and certainly all neurosurgery.
In private practice, were you solo, or were you in a group to begin with?
I was solo.
In which hospitals were you operating?
I operated at a Reading Medical Center, which was called at that time Memorial Hospital of Reading. So I was the only neurosurgeon from the Oregon border up near Medford to Sacramento.
The moving to Redding was most neurosurgeons stayed around large populated areas. What led you to move to a less populated area and being the only neurosurgeon, as you were saying, from North California, I guess, at that time, or Northern California?
Great question, Reg. I would think that dates back to when I was in New York City and I got on a subway system and I went from Columbia Presbyterian up near George Washington Bridge down to the American Hospital of, or the American Museum of Natural History, and saw the diorama of an elk. And I always had this, I'd like to live in the West. Redding was, California was obviously in the West near the Sierra Mountains. By this time we had four children, and we just decided that the big city life, the urban life was not for us. If I could affect an area that had a large triage area that could support a neurosurgeon. So from it was a big decision to leave the university and to go to a small town. The hospital administrator, which Dr. Gene Stead last evening, when he came out a few years later, he met this hospital administrator, and Mr. Robert R. Roberts was the administrator. And my deal with Mr. Roberts was I'd come to Redding if he would buy the most expensive scope in the world, this microscope, which they ordered from Switzerland, Zeiss, Carl Zeiss microscope, and with all the bells and whistles and all the microinstrumentation and all the instruments that had been developed by myself with the V. Mueller Instrument Company. V. Mueller Instrument Company that was finally bought by Cardinal, and they sold out to Allegiance Instrument Company, actually, where I'm going down to New Orleans in a couple weeks. And it was advertised as the first micro neurosurgical instruments in neurosurgery at that time. And Mr. Robert R. Roberts decided he'd buy the instrumentation and the microscope. I also needed some help with the in the nursing aspect in the ICU, so we developed a person that was well versed, a nurse, with respect to critical care in an ICU. So, and we actually, our triage area went from Reno, Nevada, on the eastern aspect of our area, across the Sierras down through Susanville to Redding, and then west from Redding over to the Hopi Indian Reservation, the Redwood Trees to Eureka, California. No neurosurgeon, no neurologist. And from Medford, Oregon down to Sacramento. So we actually had I was always very busy.
In addition to needing ICU, you needed a good team to work with. How did you go about putting together a surgical team in neurosurgery, which required somewhat different skills, I assume, or knowledge?
I operated for probably 3 or 4 weeks in the operating room. Again, I was seeing major trauma on the big highway, North and South Highway 5 in California. Airplane accidents, logging accidents, all sorts of trauma. But I was also seeing tumors and aneurysms. I didn't quite have the operative skills that I needed. My mind then went to when I was a senior resident at the University of California in San Francisco, and we had people that were skilled in surgery in terms of instrumentation, preparing the instruments before and after surgery, draping the microscope, and I had occasion to know Roger Whitaker at the University of California, and I called him one night from Redding, California to San Francisco, and explain my plight and would he ever even consider moving from San Francisco to Redding, California.
Now, Roger had been trained, I understand, in the Navy as a surgical technician.
That is correct.
And how long had he been in California when you'd met him? Do you have any idea?
Roger was a Navy corpsman in Bremerton, Washington. He came to San Francisco and was basically a surgical tech at the for one of the finest surgical supervisors in the world, Mrs. Susan Case, K-A-S-E, and he was involved in helping us do this remarkable surgery on this Tony Pacheco. And since neurosurgery didn't have a microscope, we had to borrow a microscope that was used by an ophthalmologist in another hospital, connected by hallways. And Roger had moved that almost a quarter of a mile on rollers into Suitcase's operating room, had to get blue Lux and wash the microscope down, even the wheels, bring in the OR, drape it. And Suitcase was hired Roger, and I don't know how long he was in California before.
But you met him when you were a resident then and doing the surgery.
I think I knew him through 1963 and 64. I graduated in the residency program in June of 65, went into practice one day later, and Roger then moved to Redding within a month.
Okay, so you'd met in residency, you really liked Roger and his abilities, and you needed help, and so you contacted someone you thought could help you out, basically.
I needed his kind of help in Redding if I was going to survive, because I was busy, and something went through his mind when I presented the my situation to him, and he put all his belongings in a car and moved to Redding, California.
Okay, so then you and Roger then began working together and building this team, and things were going quite well. I expect we were busy.
Exactly. We were immediately very busy. Roger was a most ethical person, quiet. It's his behavior and demeanor were a quiet kind of person. He could have been just the opposite. He was sort of a mesomorphic 171 sort of body build. I had known his technical skills, hadn't even realized that I was watching it. He just got things done well at the university. When he came to Redding, that onus was taken off my back by Roger, and his attention to detail in the operating room certainly helped. I moved to a town that had two hospitals. One was private hospital, and the other one was a private but Catholic hospital. I think in any hospital that has two hospitals, there's some politics. It would be that because Mr. Robert R. Roberts buying the microscope, instrumentation, and having an ICU nursing staff, and then allowing me to bring Roger into the operating room, allowed some enmity from the Catholic Hospital, Mercy Medical Center. I would think that it wasn't many months later that I got a note in the mail that Roger was basically practicing medicine without a license, and I was aiding and abetting the practice of Roger Whitaker without a license.
Now that was a plastic surgeon who had just moved to Redding for a few months before that or something? Had made the inquiry, I guess, to the board or something?
Yes.
Yeah.
And this plastic surgery actually was a Colonel William Shaddish. He was a military man. He worked primarily at the Catholic hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how do you spell that last name? You got any?
I'm sorry?
His last name, how you would spell it?
S-H-A-D-I-S-H.
Okay.
Yeah. Although he had probably worked with Corbin in the military, it was a political nature in this mm-hmm. town of Reading. Actually, there was a hearing officer that was set up, and there was a formal hearing in Reading, California, by the Department of Consumer Affairs. And going back on what I said earlier, Roger would never step over any line. He knew, I almost would encourage him to do different duties. He would not take that on his own. I mean, mm-hmm. it was very careful of our personal relationship. I liked him immensely.
So the motives, you think, was one, the person didn't understand exactly what was going on, but it was some competition between the hospitals. The person was new, and some reason wanted to make an inquiry to see if you guys were legit, I guess.
I think even in addition to that, he was worked at the other hospital primarily doing plastic surgery, mm-hmm. and it fit his MO to be politically aligned with this other hospital, and since I had about 95% of my practice at Memorial Hospital, that would be the genesis of that. This hearing was, and I kept reading about the newspapers, and I will provide you with some of the newspapers. My
Great.
Wife Jana Great. Can, when we get out to Reading this summer, I'll go back and get the newspapers, which had Rogers and I pictures on the paper day in, day out.
So this was big news in Reading, and how was the paper handling this? Was they more pro, leaning towards the use of someone to help you, or they were just kind of reporting it straightforward? Or?
Well, it was more like the Terry Schiavo case. It just ended currently. Fair. But when you're involved in it, just like listening to people on CNN and Fox, depends where what your perspective is.
Yeah.
I was a defendant, so anything on the newspaper seemed like a thrust at me personally, although I think the paper was very fair.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically...
So first you went through a hearing just to see if there was a basis to the case.
Yes.
And then out of that hearing, then the DA got involved from the results of the hearing? Or
district attorney was Robert Baker. He may have been the person who got the inquiry from Dr. Shaddish at Mercy Hospital. He may have called the Consumer Affairs Board in Sacramento. They would have come up and set a hearing date. We had nurses from the University of California testify that what Roger did at the University of California. Mm-hmm. And then out of the blue, it was sort of like paratroopers coming out of the sky, came a very senior officer in the United States Navy from Washington who testified as to Roger's qualifications and what he did in the service. And for the first time, I heard the name of Dr. Stead. How he came to a little town called Reading and how he found out about the case, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
Or can't remember. But in any case, he indicated that this was a new field on the horizon in terms of physician assistance. He presented himself, and I think I'm going to get a picture of him in the Reading newspaper.
Oh, great.
I can just... certainly what he said, And
so that now this was at the hearing, not at the actual court case. It was later a trial, right, with the Whitaker versus Shasta County. That was actually a formal trial.
I can't remember whether they were combined as such, but the newspaper event will help me answer that question more thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was late 65?
Yes.
All this was happening.
Yeah.
Okay. So as far as Dr. Stead, you're saying this person, apparently this was being picked up by other people then. It was moving from Reading to California Press on out to more of a national attention, and people were picking up on the
yes.
the trial, and as we said, people were already thinking about using military trained people in civilian roles, so there was already an environment, I assume, of people being interested in this and was picking up on it.
I would think that that's definitely the case. Inquiries that came to my office, of course, again, during this time, I'm fully involved in, I couldn't sign out to anybody.
You got a lawyer, I assume, just as soon as you understood a hearing was coming up, or did you just say, I'll go talk to these folks myself and straighten it out?
I'll have to review my notes at that time on that issue.
There's a Gerald Pickering, a lawyer.
Yes.
Yeah.
He was a local lawyer and
okay.
had no background, and P-I-C-K-E-R-I-N-G, Gerald Pickering.
Mm-hmm.
He may have just handled the triage through the hearing date mm-hmm. in this trial. But there was two questions that I can't answer, and hope I was going to ask Dr. Stead last night, but he obviously met Roger Whitaker when he was in Reading.
Right.
And I don't know whether it was over unsweetened iced tea or a dinner, or obviously Dr. Stead liked Roger Whitaker as much as I did, and his interface was very short, but he offered Roger a job back at Duke University.
Mm-hmm.
And
also the opportunity to go through the PA program that he had.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Just yes. Mm-hmm. And with that in mind. And Roger had to move his family. He, by that time, he was married to Charlene. And it took some, there was some stress both in Roger and myself going through this material.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that by that time I had, Roger had trained other nursing staff to continual repetition of how instruments should be passed, looking mm-hmm. at watching the TV set in the operating room to know anticipating what instruments I would need.
So the length of time that you practiced together before the hearing and all that was, were you in practice about a year?
Yes.
Okay, and that before all this happened, so you had this long year of experience
right.
working together. Then this happened. Again, I'm a little mixed up between the hearing and the actual trial where the DA was involved, and actually you were, I think there were three counts. All of them had to do with emergency type surgery cases, mm-hmm. as I recall from reading mm-hmm. your letters. My understanding as it went through the system, two of the cases were, you were not guilty. It was proven these were handled correctly. There was only one questionable and guilty, and then there was an appeal process. So I'm not real clear on the stages of how this unfolded, whether there was a hearing and then the DA decided to go ahead and prosecute, and this went before a jury. And then out of that came, there was three counts. Two counts were dismissed and one was left there, and then there was an appeal on that one. Does that sound right?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
And you're refreshing my memory a little bit too. During this time, the district attorney's son fell off a bicycle and had a head injury and was brought into the emergency room, and I'm the only neurosurgeon there.
it was decided by the district attorney that I would care for his son rather than the alternative was to ship him to the closest neurosurgeon, which would have been an air flight to either San Francisco.
So this was a DA who was prosecuting you. His son was in an accident, back accident.
Yes.
And you were the person, you and Roger were the two individuals that had to take care of his son.
Exactly. It turned out well. He did, that sort of ameliorated the Robert Baker's antipathy, mm-hmm. If there was any. It was sort of like the trauma cases, like there are three cases and it came mm-hmm. down to one. I mean, I think the whole emphasis would have been that Roger Whitaker was helping a neurosurgical unit getting started in one hospital and not the other. It was...
So it really came out that this was this competition and some bad feeling between the two hospitals because of the way things had worked out, one hospital compared to the other.
Yeah, that's 99% of it. Yeah. There was another thing that some general practitioners, which were second, which would be first assistants, mm. felt that the intrusion of this particular entity, being a Navy corpsman, would have been, and there were no PAs. The PA was not as...
Right. Just a concept developing over on the East Coast, right?
That's right. It was not a West Coast concept. It sort of turned out that Roger did a first assist me on major trauma in the middle of the night while the first, but we always tried to get a physician or a...
But there were people who wrote letters or testified to the fact that even in the university hospital, that it was not necessary even to have a first assistant. Many operations were done without first assistants and using nursing or surgical assistants in that role.
Exactly.
So what you were doing was not uncommon even in the university system, in the academic medical centers.
Exactly.
And there was testimony to that fact, I recall.
And at that time also the drills, we now use a drill in neurosurgery. We actually take a drill that's power driven and it goes through the skull and it makes a small hole from the outer cortex through the inner table and it stops. You make four holes like that, then you switch drills that has a foot plate and it will connect those four holes so you can take out a bone flap. In major trauma, you want to get that bone flap off as fast as possible, open the dura and let the blood cut pressure abate. And in those cases, the fact that we were putting in with a burr hole mm-hmm. and a perforator before the drills really didn't come out at that time. There was a Midas Rex drill that came out a few years later. I'd put in a drill, then I would hold the drill tip and have Roger just do the cranking.
Yeah, right.
And that was the aspect that probably that one case that you mentioned that, you know.
So he was doing, quote, the surgery, but actually manually turning the crank.
And Roger was not the person that was ever decided where the burr hole would be put, how much pressure. It was, he was just, as I say, a quiet, could follow my orders or decisions or communications.
Now, so after the case and this, Roger wasn't barred from then first assisting you. He stayed on in the practice. Did you feel you were vindicated, or did you have to go through an appeal process to get to that final vindication, or did the DA just kind of drop things after the accident and you guys had worked on his son? And
I'll have to find out about the appeal process by Gerald Pickering. I think that Roger then came to from Redding, California to Durham, North Carolina and started the program.
So there wasn't any need to go through an appeal or so forth because Roger basically kind of dropped out of the scene and you weren't anyway punished medically or put on probation.
Roger had a fine, which I paid, which is minuscule, I think $250. My memory is...
And that was for turning the crank?
Right.
Okay.
And I think that I was... my license was suspended for 30 days, but it was...
you basically paid the fine and you were 30-day probation, basically, but you were allowed to continue because you were the only act in town, so to speak.
Exactly. I think at that time it was a... I can't remember how long after that. I'm going to guess it was 10 months to a year and a half later. I got another letter from the Department of Consumer Affairs and went down to Sacramento to help them set up what they felt was licensure for this new concept of physician mm-hmm. assistance, because by that time they realized it was coming to California mm-hmm. and there was no licensure for physician assistance at that time. They heard from Dr. Stead how important it would be, and that certainly Mr. Whitaker had done less than he'd ever done in the service in Bremerton mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. Navy when helping me in terms of making decisions that would have medical consequences.
Now, as I recall talking to Dr. Stead, I was under the impression that someone from Redding, either you or the lawyer or someone, had contacted him. Eventually you and he spoke by phone, and one of Stead's stories is that he said he would come out, but he had a young family, and he understood that he was going to have to take a small plane to fly from the major airport out to Redding, and the only thing he requested was that not only that his travel be covered, but that you take out some insurance, flight insurance, so that if the plane crashed, he his family would be taken care of. Does that ring a bell, or does that sound
sounds
true?
Like Gene said, it sounds, I could validate that. So there would probably be, that may have been a call from Gerald Pickering mm-hmm. to Gene Stead. And if he flew either into San Francisco or to Sacramento, it would be...
But it's nothing you and the lawyer got together. It's probably the lawyer figured out this guy was training PAs and he'd be a good witness and called him in, or...
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's the way it was. I don't think Gene had picked up on it and said, gee, I need to go out there and testify. I think there was something that came from California brought his attention to this. And so this was 1965, 66. And so he comes out and he testifies. And I assume a typical Gene Stead just was very practical and pretty much laid it out, and so his testimony helped in, you think, the convincing the jury. Yeah,
there's no question. Whether it was at the hearing officer, I can almost see his face, or the trial, but it was. I do remember his picture in the newspaper, mm-hmm. which would be a full recount of his testimony. So I could pull that up and get that to you this summer.
Now, Walter McKenzie, who was president of the American College of Surgeons, all of a sudden the American College of Surgeons got interested in this because they knew from custom and use that the use of surgical assistance, and they were thinking we need more surgical assistance to help us. So this kind of became a test case for them too. They did not want to see surgeons not being able to use non-physicians in helping them in practice. Was this
pretty much
the way it happened? So even the American College of Surgeons were pro in the sense of what you were doing was, they felt appropriate and was by custom was something that was already being done.
Exactly.
Right. So they had no problems with you using Roger in the role that you were using him in at all. In fact, were supportive of this.
And that gets right down to the local level. Mm-hmm. And Roger couldn't have come into a hospital unless he went through the credentials committee
right.
of a hospital that was Was Jayco around in 1966?
Yeah, well, it was. Yeah, it got started in the, I believe in the 50s, but I'm not sure. I have to go back and check. We're in the early 60s.
I think so.
Yeah.
But
he was credentialed in the hospital. There's no doubt about his training. He had been employed at a major university system, so there was no question about his qualifications as a surgeon assistant, nor his credentialing on the local level. It just got into the first assisting, where the gray zone was for people in talking back. So that seemed to be the bulk of the discussion.
And he first assisted or second assisted at the University of California.
Right, right.
And I believe Sue Case came up to Reading and testified
to that
as to his credentials and the remarkable way that he handled himself at the university before I ever employed him.
Now, you told me earlier that you and Roger had to develop a lot of instrumentation for the things you were doing, and Roger had played a role in actually designing and coming up with the idea for some instruments that eventually your name went on them because he was a non-physician, but that you gave him credit for.
That's true.
For developing a number of things. So he was technically very good, and he had the ability to see the kinds of things you might need to...
Well, even more than that, in neurosurgery, microscopes in Durham, Dr. Alan Friedman probably yesterday was operating, I know he was, with a microscope that's attached to the ceiling that comes down, and with the contravis kind of manipulation and the TV set, it's all counterbalance. It's just like having a little feather and you direct what you're going to see. Back in 1964, when we had the 2100 millimeter stand, which was about 7 feet tall, and it was used for eye, to attach a 35 millimeter camera, to attach the first black and white TV set, to attach a 16 millimeter movie camera to the actual eyepieces with a beam splitter, as well as the observer tube, so the assistant could look through the observer tube. This thing almost weighed like a ton, and when you had to move it just an inch
just
or two, that was all done with Roger's technical ability. Roger worked with Jack Urban when he came to the university to sort of see how we would counterbalance that so we could actually operate with this non-balanced camera and operating room microscope, and his technical ability. And then also, if you're going to do this, Dr. Stevenson, Roger would say, how are we going to drape it so it's sterile? I mean, this is long before clear plastic, which covers the all operating room things, whether it's otologic, ophthalmologic, or neurosurgery. Currently, we used double muslin. So sterile muslin was put over all the eyepieces, and Roger had to figure all that out. I couldn't have done it.
Yeah. So, I think it speaks well of him as an individual, his technical, his knowledge, his ability to see things, and to work as a team member. It sounds like he had a lot of things going for him the offer then to come to Duke and work and become a PA, and what he had just gone through and maybe being able to legitimize the role by becoming a PA certified. This was right when Duke was beginning to think about model legislation. In fact, it was a couple years later that I believe Harvey got the grant and they started developing model legislation. But from my perspective, this case, Whitaker, Sashta County, really brought national prominence to the plight of military corpsmen and physicians trying to hire and utilize these kinds of individuals. So all of a sudden, California becomes kind of the state in which legislation and people are moving forward to trying to define how we're going to use surgical assistants or other assistants. So do you feel now, looking back in perspective you have now, that actually that's the case, that the case there really did probably move things along fast in California as people were trying to work through this? So was this a stimulus, as I think it was?
I'm mentally certain of that case because mm-hmm. I was emotionally a defendant in this hearing trial.
Right.
And I became then a proponent for this by request from the Consumer Affairs, calling me maybe between 9 and 18 months later to come down and work out the certification and credentialing.
It sounds like, yeah, it sounds like they had already set up something like an allied health panel or committee or something that they were thinking that they needed to do something about this. This case came about, and then all of a sudden, yeah, let's get this committee going and let's make things happen. Was that kind of the way it was?
Yeah.
So it all kind of came together at the same time. So the case was just sparked people now getting serious about doing something.
Exactly. And actually, I went down to Sacramento probably 15 years later, mm-hmm. maybe less than that, to go to the board of medical licensure.
Right.
Since my license was suspended for 15 days or 30 days, but not. And I wanted a copy by, Freedom Act.
Mm-hmm.
Freedom Act. They couldn't find it. It had been expunged from my medical licensure thing. And I said, no, I don't have mind. I just said, go back and they couldn't find that I even had the trial and nothing, you know, like so many after some, I was doing it for historical reasons.
Yeah.
And the history had been erased from the blackboard.
There was a guy, there's a letter in there from Edward Forgeston, I believe is the way you pronounce his name. He was a lawyer MD down at University of California. He picked up on this. You had correspondence with him. Ed later becomes involved in the model legislation that's being developed by Estes, who had brought together people there. So it sounds like California, again, where this had happened, his interest in this particular case kind of sparked him then getting involved in developing model legislations for PAs. So is that pretty much how that came about?
Yes, it is.
And did you recommend him to Stead and others as you corresponded with him? Or
I may have, and I may be able to get that correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
Or it may be in our domicile, either in Case Western Reserve Medical School, where I got some of these letters are done in Florida. But
mm-hmm.
There was a lot of interest that people...
you were getting letters from all over the country.
All over the country, nationally, in terms of... because actually, the interest in using a Navy corpsman,
mm-hmm.
and how I could see in most of these letters, the motif was to... how can I personally, whether I'm living in Kansas or Florida, get a Navy corpsman without getting in the same trouble you did, Dr. Stevenson? Mm-hmm. Probably didn't say that tacitly, but and by that time the emphasis was hearing what Gene Stead had to say at the hearing and our trial, and this senior person from the Navy, from the Navy Department of Washington, D.C. It was a movement that was obviously on the rise.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Vietnam War was just beginning to heat up, I guess, at that time too. So a lot of people were starting to get drafted in. So the aspect of more military corpsmen and being trained. So it just seemed like the context of the time. There was a lot of thinking and a lot of thoughts along this line. So it just kind of came together. Roger then moves on and goes to Durham and eventually goes through the PA program and becomes a PA and a leader, eventually becoming the president of the American Academy of PAs and back to Oklahoma, helping Bill Stanhope through the VA system establish a PA program in Oklahoma, and tragically dies young, certainly leaving his mark on the PAs, both with the case that kind of opens the door. We need legislation. We need to think about how we can integrate ex-military Corps-trained people into civilian work life, giving some national promise to the idea of formally training people to the civilian role, certifying them, developing model legislation, and all those kinds of things. And you got to know Gene Stead and started corresponding with him, and then becoming an advocate yourself for legislation and roles and transition and so forth. How do you feel about all that? I mean, in a way, this was not something you wished on yourself, but all of a sudden it pushed you into the PA arena.
Well, there's no question it did. I would, and some of that is collated in a big box that I received from his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Jen and I are going to, I'm giving this interview in Mebane.
Mm-hmm.
And today's date, but it's a. Gave his Navy career, his letter of commendation when he was in the Navy.
Oh, great.
Pictures, and then it was a, and we present, we're going to find this box and send it to you with how he evolved from a Navy corpsman to really helping me.
I mean, right.
Helping the University of California in San Francisco. Certainly that wasn't my perspective only. I mean, Dr. Ronald Stoney, who was a chief resident and wrote the paper.
Right.
Ron is became emeritus professor of vascular surgery and is currently going into the university on once a week to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And Roger helped him help. And I think that he didn't do just neuro surgery. I think he may have helped Ron on vascular surgery mm-hmm. procedures before this famous case.
Right.
And I don't know that he was the only Navy corpsman hired by University of California. I can talk to Sue Case about that. But it was a certainly. My feeling was I don't know behavior of different corpsmen, but you know. Roger was perfect for me, he was perfect for the university. I mean, his general behavior and intelligence and quietness.
Yeah.
He was a quiet guy.
Yeah.
And
well, I knew Roger, he was quiet, but he could also have fun times. And and he was hilarious. He had a dry sense of humor, but loved life too. And I enjoyed that part of Roger.
Now, where were you when that happened? I mean,
Roger had graduated before I came to Duke, but I got to know Roger through the academy and Bill Stanhope and those early graduates. Since they were Duke graduates, they all kind of, you know, would take me under their protection, so to speak, as I was a PhD breaking into the educational process with the Duke connection. And so I got to know Roger through at meetings and on committees and things of that nature. So.
Now, Reg, the PhD was in what?
Physiology, pharmacology at Wake Forest University, Bowman Gray School of Medicine.
And then, how did you get associated with Duke from
that background? I came there as a research fellow, and they had just started the baccalaureate degree for PAs, and I was asked to go over and teach physiology to these PA students. Didn't know anything much about them, although Wake Forest had started the program. But the technician in our laboratory, research laboratory, her husband was in the PA program. And so I talked to her a little bit about it and found out most of these people were just high school graduates. And I thought, well, how in the world am I going to teach medical physiology? Went over and started teaching, and these were the most motivated learners I'd ever seen in my life and just fell in love. I came out of the rural North Carolina where we had one GP who did surgery and everything else. So the role in what they were trying to do just kind of fit into something I believed in very well. And then the director and the associate director both went to Florida to set up a PA program there and a family medicine residency program. And lucky to me, I was working in the hyperbaric chamber, which played a background and a role in the first PAs being at Duke. And everyone knew everyone. And my teaching role, Harvey Estes called me up and said, hey, you want to kind of come over and get the medical education and be the associate director for the program, and later if you want to go to medical school or become a PA yourself, I'll be glad to do that for you, and it wouldn't be bad for you even if you go back full-time in research.
So how did you decide?
It took me a while to decide because I was geared for research, but those were the days of the Vietnam War was eating up, money was becoming less and less, harder to get grants unless you were an established researcher. And I found that medical education teaching was something, or helping people learn was something I really had a knack and enjoyed doing. So I never looked back, and I became a PA myself. So that's kind of
you did become a PA.
Yeah, and that's kind of the way I got pulled into this thing.
The PhD was at Wake Forest.
Yes, mm-hmm. And the PA was at Duke.
And the PhD was in physiology.
Uh-huh.
Given, would that be? How's that separate from the medical school?
Well, they had started a PhD program in the medical school, so I was based in the Department of Physiology. Hal Green was chairman there, and I think Hal Green was at Case Western as a physiologist researcher before he came to Wake Forest. So.
When you defended your PhD, what kind of research did you do?
Cardiovascular research, and mostly on autoregulation and skeletal muscle was what I was looking at in research.
Interesting.
And then I came to Duke and got interested in lymphatic system and the transfer of materials across the capillary network, and worked with Dr. Rankin, who eventually went out to Davis and I think became chair of physiology.
In Sacramento?
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting these connections. Let me ask you one more thing. That was Time Magazine, December 31st, 1965. Did the Time Magazine actually run an article about this case? There's a letter that mentioned that someone had read this in Time, and I just assume it was Time Magazine.
The date is what?
What it said there, it said December 30th, but I looked up Time Magazine, it was a December 31, 1965 issue. Someone had written a letter, and we can look at it, that said that they had read about the case in Time Magazine. So I need to get a copy of that Time Magazine if I can get my hands on it. So.
Do you read it? No, when I get a copy of this,
okay,
that'll be so I can spur.
Okay.
Because actually, in April of 1965, the Time Magazine on this article that Roger helped us with, Tony Pacheco, mm-hmm. with our pictures and the pictures of the work that he had helped us with at the University of California, was in Time Magazine. I always remembered that the front of the Time Magazine had a picture of the famous ballerine, or Nuria, mm-hmm. was on the picture.
So that operation actually hit Time Magazine. Was back in 60.
I can get a copy of it. Okay. I lost it. I called Time Magazine, and they researched it out and sent me the.
Okay.
And I'll send you that one.
Well, I think that covers most things, and it gives us now an oral history tape of your views of that. We can, if we have more questions, we can always add to this tape with over the telephone or something of that nature.
And actually, the thing that Roger helped us with wasn't in Time Magazine only. It was Medical Economics, Medical Tribune, Journal of Neurosurgery, when we presented this in Copenhagen, in Denmark, Roger's ability to, how he helped us with it at the university, not private practice, but we have copies of all those.
Okay. Just to finish up the tape, after Roger leaves, you stay in Reading practicing how many more years?
30.
30 years. Okay, so you eventually semi-retire from practice out of that practice, or do you go?
Yep.
Okay.
Basically, developed other neurosurgeons and neurologists to come there.
Mm-hmm.
We actually gave Jana Stevenson, my wife, gave lectures, and CME to doctors, BRN credit, Jenna's name in Sacramento, and BRN credit for nurses and PAs that were in the area that were then coming in at that time. They would come, we had biannually, and we would actually have the PAs, nurses, and docs that wanted to put gloves on, and then they would cut brains. Mm-hmm. Where do we get the brains? From the coroner. The coroner would save brains that from road accidents, we would And then we had a Dr. Jeff Minkler, who was a very famous neuropathologist, lived in Eureka, retired in Eureka, mm-hmm. California, mm-hmm. come over and give lectures. And we had with a professor of neurology from Portland, Stanford, UC, on these continuing education teaching things. Mm-hmm. The only problem with that was that a month after you give the course, I would get a call at 2 a.m. At my home from some nurse that had been taking the course. Mm-hmm. And well, why if the thalamus is here and the nerves crossed and the peduncles, why is this? She'd be calling from the ICU to my home. Almost getting too much information.
Consulting on the phone.
And
yeah.
it was yeah. neat to see that new yeah. clothes mm-hmm. in the care of my patients. Mm-hmm. This is a triage area where mm-hmm. referring hospitals would, yeah. would send their nurses and right. PAs, and but it was a great feedback for doing this.
Oh, that's great.
And actually, we then put on a course in San Francisco in 1984 with for doctors.
Excuse me, George.
Yeah, and these doctors came from Montreal, Switzerland, Chicago, for a first micro-neurosurgical course, which was basically based on this